Heineken lowered its property value relative to what it was before the shul started, or relative to what it was when the shul was thriving? I don't know. Right? And lowering property values is not something that anybody has shown up, so far as I can tell, in any previous literature.
Asset.
Yeah, it depreciates his asset.
Why should it matter whether it's property or material goods?
Well, it's not going to be material goods. The question is whether it is depreciating his income or his assets.
Secondary. It sounds like the other one is for his assets. His income. The smaller group, he can't survive on the membership dues of a smaller group.
Yeah, and by the way, he's also lost his assets. But since when is loss of assets a relevant category?
When you lower the price on something, all of a sudden my stock of whatever I have is now worth significantly less.
What if it's a stock you don't intend to sell?
Since he doesn't necessarily want to sell the shul.
Yeah, right. If it's not an expected income, that's real estate, right? It'll maybe, the real estate price is going to be affected by many, many things other than the market. And for all he knows, he intends to own it for 100 years. And by the time, he's done, they'll be building a 500-story tower on it. Because otherwise, they'll be underwater. Because, right. whatever. Yes, if
maybe everyone's secretly doing it. They're always planning to sell for 5 years. And they really should have stuck it out a bit to make it work more so that he could sell somebody they would have liked.
They have all kinds of conspiracy theories. Maybe they're just hoping to force him to sell so they can have his building and build a shul there. Who knows? Yes, Ellie.
I'm guessing that since the income of a rabbi is so weird, that he has so many different sources of income, and they're all sort of not great on their own, but together he can collect a normal income. Maybe that's why the Rav Moshe is sensitive to the lost assets.
Maybe. I just don't know how halachically this fits into the category.
Because for a rabbi, his umnas is
real estate.
What?
His umnas is selling his real estate?
Apparently.
That seems like a very... There was a yeshiva on the west side that parents were fond of telling about that there are lawsuits about this. There was one in Brookline about this recently, but it was one where their job... You found a failing shul, right? You brought in your yeshiva students to make the minyan. Then you bought membership for your yeshiva students. Then you had a majority. Then you voted the shul out of existence, sold the business, sold the shul, pocketed the asset, right, put the assets in your shiva, and moved on to make the next minion.
That's a hot takeover.
That's
corporate, right? That's like Bain Kemper.
That's great.
There is a failing minion in the Heights.
There, it happened here.
Huge amounts of assets. Right?
There was a big issue here. It happened with failing conservative shuls and Orthodox minion name also. Yes.
Has incredible assets.
So my issue is that to me it seems like almost completely
to
the funeral home case.
Yeah.
Right? Because both of these, you have someone who has a monopoly over something.
Mm-hmm.
In the funeral home case, it's like pricing that's being, with which he's taking advantage of people, right? But here you have him doing a poor job on a necessary service. He's not doing it well. He has a captive audience.
So let's ask a very straightforward question. Does Rav Moshe think the rabbi has a job?
Yes.
No.
What?
Does Rav Moshe think the rabbi has a job?
Otherwise none of this would apply.
Does he have a job? Is there anything a rabbi has to do?
Yes.
Learn.
What?
No. It can't be that he just gets to hold on to the building and sit there.
Why not?
Because then it's not...
No, but I'm serious because
he sees it as a business.
Yes.
Business by necessity requires some input.
Yes. He has to maintain the building. He has to maintain the building.
You really think Moshe finds the same thing that all a rabbi has to do?
I don't know that he thinks that this Rebbe is a rabbi. I think that he is the owner. I think he's the owner of a shul.
And people have to pay him for the right to use the shul.
Yeah.
So then they should be able to tell him he doesn't get to talk. Or have any kind of... The fact that he has control over what happens at the shul, I think proves that.
So that is a very interesting question, how Rav Moshe would react if the people said, we're perfectly happy to stay, on condition that the Rav never speaks.
Right. I don't think that's how he sees it. I think he sees them having a role in the shul.
I don't know, I think it's an interesting question, but I don't think that would be an economic issue anymore. I think then he would talk about kavod and chazaka and things like that. I think that would be a very different question. But you're saying that he's doing the bad job, right? That being a bad job implies that the rabbi has a job, and that he's responsible to the congregants to do a job. I don't know that he thinks... Now, if the congregants came, now this is part of the same issue, the congregants came and said, the rabbi makes errors when we ask him kashrus shilos. Right? So that's a very interesting question, whether how Rav Moshe would hold. Right? If they came and they said, right, we need a rabbi who paskins kashrus questions accurately. Because he might think that that's part of the right, that the part of the job of the rabbi is to provide adequate halachic guidance. If they came and they said the rabbi is incapable of learning a black gemara, and we need a shir, I don't know what he would say.
But he brings in the Torah study stuff later, right?
Where does he bring in Torah study?
Right? Am I making that up?
I don't think he brings in Torah study in this.
Okay.
I don't think so. So I think it's an interesting question. What are the minimal responsibilities of a rabbinic figure who is the proprietor of a shul? For Rav Moshe. Because that's what it is, right? What services can the congregation legitimately demand of a rabbi? And I think the answer is going to be fairly minimal. And pastoral attitude. Once you daven there, I think he might say is... Although I have to say, it's I don't deny that this is weird, and it is always sort of interesting for me because, as I said often, I didn't grow up in a community with a rabbi, so the whole institution of shul rabbi is still something that I am still assimilating, because I davened in room 101 at YU, so we never had a rabbi, where did my family daven? Most of my family is daven at shtiples, so this is a world I recognize. And the non-Orthodox world in that regard of the shul rabbi is still something that I am assimilating. Okay. So this is the... So Rav Moshe claims that this is Mahapik Becharora and Yoredo Naso. Why? Because the Chasam Sofer says that if there isn't space for both of them, then it's Yored Lamanut, even if you have a right to be there because it's Bar Masa, even according to so-and-so. And then he adds the line that becomes really important in the RCAYU world. The Afsha Dayan Yishru Eslon Hashem Espalim Sham Kevin Shehuktan Aminian Kolkach Ad Shein Lo Kidei Chayav Vuzali Dezei Bedek Tetsmin Lo Shalom Vodah Vodah Kipuach Pernas Hashu Osir. And then he adds another thing. When Furish came to Rashi Bav Masih Adav Ayin Aleph Dimamach Lo Yored Da'af Rak Limay Mizonatav Shel Chavero Osir Bedin Yored Lumnos Chavero. So Rav Moshe is right that whenever right, that Rashi consistently or at least in some part, as Rashi is consistent, because in one place he rejects the possibility that he accepts in the other place. But Rashi talks about mi'ut parnasato in both Bava Metzia and Kiddushin.
This is the place where he says that can't be what Yoreh
L'Chayav. Pardon?
This is the place where he says that can't be what
Yoreh L'Chayav. Yes, right. So Rashi Bava Metzia says, but that can't, right? How would we even let him do that?
Right.
But he defines Yoreh Lumnos Chavero along as Lemayit Mazonatav V'Leireh Lumnato. So Moshe says, so simply Lemayit Mazonatav must be enough of an Isser. And then he has a line which is introduced by Upashit, which is always a warning sign.
Can you just translate this before we talk about it? Because
even just to limit a person's mizonos is forbidden.
No, that's Upashit line.
Right. So it's obvious. Shekidei chayav, right? That the meaning of kidei chayav, which is his standard, right? That he says that if you lower his mizonot to the point where it's not kidei chayav, that's considered right. That is already a violation of Yored Lamato. Mikri, right? So what the definition of that term is, Kederech HaHotza LaAnashim Benonim MiMedragato BaChashivut. It's the amount of disposable expense, right? That occurs to middling people of the same social status. Right. That's what kidei chayav is. Kidei chayav is the capacity to hold up your head in society. So you have to make the median income of your social status, and he does not tell you how you define social status. And then he has a further claim on the next page. Once again, I forgot the number, didn't I? So on page 4.
This point it would just be confusing if you
So on page 4, the Moshe goes along and he has an additional chiddush, and he says, it's worse because they're not trying to make money. Because the whole hetter to compete is that, well, look, just like you need to make money, I need to make money. But they don't need to make money, they just need to daven. What gives you the right to hurt someone's income just because you need to daven? Right, so it's a fascinating story. He says, look, for competition, right, you might say, okay, you can't compete with the other guy in the business, but you're allowed to say, as long as we're both competing, I'm not putting you out of business, so who says you get to live? I get to live, right? But you have to cook me. But if I get nothing out of this. All I get is a shul that I like. So why is a shul that I like a value that is worth hurting someone else economically? Now that, by the way, think of it that way, right? If that's a great Mr. Shmuz, right? Now we go back to Avraham Avinu and Hafel Sesarchim. Right. What right do you, are you saying, you know what, it's worth, that here's this old man, and he's going to live in poverty for the rest of his life. Why? Because you feel you need better kavana. How can you possibly have kavana when you know that down the block there's this old man who's sitting there miserable, and it's right, and can't marry off his kids?
Pardon? He's a fascist, or a communist, or one of the two. I mean, they hate him. They don't care.
But they should. They should. What kind of shul is this, right? Which is grounded on we need to have kavana. So we are right. Probably the same way Ahavas Achim is the split shul. So this will be right. This will be the social justice shul.
That's being very generous, though, to say that they have just because they need more kavana. It sounds like.
I'm just putting out. Best case scenario, right? They say that right. We don't enjoy davening there because we don't like the rabbi. So be inclusive. And we could reverse this, right? It's just because we think that the rabbi is the one responsible for the atmosphere of the shul, right? So this all rests on suppositions about the role of the rabbi, which are fun to challenge. Yes, Pramacha.
But it's not that they don't like the rabbi. So they think very legitimately that the rabbi doesn't like them. They feel threatened and don't want to stay in a shul with the rabbi who keeps calling them Goyish communists.
Yes, well, I think that's, we're not there, and we don't know what's really going on with the, I don't really know what's going on with the rabbi. Maybe just a mismatch that he's hot-tempered, and they don't get his hot-tempered, and maybe he's a little crazy. It's very likely he's a little bit crazy. Yes, Ellie?
Where does he get, going back a step, where does he get this, the level of a Madriga Sabbath-Sheepus? What is that?
He made it up.
Is there any indication from the
Gemara
for
sure
that we saw?
No, it's
Pashas. Wait, so why is that? Why is that a red flag? It says Pashas.
What do you mean a red flag? You say it's Pashas, it means you don't have evidence. If you had evidence, you would say Varaya.
Seriously?
Umuchroch.
So,
all people. Whatever you say, right, these truths are self-evident. It means you have no argument.
Can I cross this out?
Let me cross it out. You should always look right. The story I always tell about this is when I wrote my first Beis Yitzchak article. Right. Basically, is why you use the right thing. So I wrote my first piece. So they made me take out all the Lanius Datis. Because they said, this isn't the Chiddush. Right? Lanius Dati really means, I have a Chiddush. Right? And it's really not your original idea. You can't write Lanius Dati. Right, so code is Lanu Dati means I have a chiddush. Lule de Mistafina Mechavre, right, if I were not afraid of my friends, means I have a really big chiddush.
I'm Pashut. So why'd you write Lanu Dati if you?
So I thought, I thought I was being humble, right? I like to think I thought I was being humble and saying, you know what, this is an arguable point. But they said it's an arguable point. That's true, but you're not the only one who's argued it. Right, say Efsher. Lanius Dati is a. So they maybe take them out and correctly so. Yes.
Can I propose what I might think is a helpful analogy?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm thinking about elections, right? Yeah. Like the mean voter theorem and the median voter theorem, right? The problem with our democratic system is that it creates two extreme parties.
Yeah.
And so the problem with, we have to think of like the rabbi in your Moshe's time is in that position, right? If you open up. Right. He's providing a public service, but he is a better rabbi as long as everyone in the community is in his shul.
Yeah.
And then everyone in the community has equal power and equal influence on the rabbi, and he's in a position of authority.
Yeah.
But as soon as you open up another shul, he is forced to become extreme to keep his
Oh, that's very nice. But Ramosha doesn't mention any of this. He just
no, I know. I'm
money.
Just trying to conceptualize this. I think, like, I don't know. Maybe other people are becoming more warm to this, but I have, like, totally no idea how to think about this problem otherwise. And this just makes no sense compared to how we think about... Like, there's almost no other industry where we think about this, where we think like this. Right?
Well, no, where we think like this, Ramosha thinks like this about every industry.
Well, sorry, right now. I mean, I think even if, like, Ramosha's economic reasoning doesn't... There's almost no industry right now that functions this way, where we think that his reasoning makes any sense. In an ethical sense...
Who's we?
Most...
People who haven't read Ramosha's trivias and taken them as law.
No, but I mean, like, even people who do take them as law still don't... Most people don't find them, like, relevant to the economic reality we live in now, do they?
I don't know.
I don't know. Okay, the point is... How do we, if we think, as long as we think about a rabbi or like any other employee or like any other service provider, right? We function in an economy where if your service provider is failing to provide a service, you find another one, and there's absolutely no reason you shouldn't.
So this is the big question. So what comes out of this tshuva, right? Which for the right. So first question: are they separate? Moshe has one thesis about the responsibilities of shuls generally and this shul towards the rabbi, and that's one big thing. Then he has. He has a separate claim, which I think is not so separable, that even the people who think that you're allowed to, that it's not a problem so long of hasaga gvul, so long as you enable the other person to compete with you and there's enough space for you both, right? Even if you diminish their business, that doesn't apply, says Ramosha, if the new entrant is not economically interested. Right, that's a very counterintuitive perspective. We might think if they're not economically interested, so they're not being venal, right? They're not, right? Ramosha says, no, they're worse. So that, I think, is a connected point. But then Ramosha has a point that is, in principle, entirely different, which is, what is the standard? At which point Hasaga Gvul becomes an issue. How much damage do you have to do to the other party? And here he creates a standard. The standard he creates is, right, do you diminish his income below the point, right, below the midpoint, the median income of people of his social status? Now, he doesn't define his social status. We'll see that will become, later, the median income of people engaged in that business, which is not all Rav Moshe says. All right, I think Rav Moshe says median income of people of that social status.
Is that what Where does it become that?
If you read Aaron Levine...
I feel like he said what... No, I feel like he said Shad in Rav Moshe in the 70s. Maybe it changed.
This is the Rav Moshe.
I know.
You think Aaron Levine's... Okay, fine. Let's take the... Didn't the chocolate chiva quote this?
Yeah.
And how did they quote the standard?
That was from 3 years ago.
Right, so how did they quote the standard?
Anything.
Pardon?
Basically anything. Any significant change in...
Significant change in...
And like, what he could afford to buy before and what he can afford to buy now.
Yes, right. They define it by his prior status. Which is an interesting move. I think Rav Moshe was defining it by... You know, some kind of long-term social status in this tshuva. Yes, Ephraim.
So if people say donate something to Center for Ontario Leadership 1 year and it raises your salary, then they have a few to donate the same amount or higher next year to keep them in the same social status?
Long-term social status.
So long as they're using my, you know, and they have to only learn from my website, presumably. And I get to call them communists if I want.
that's assuming that
the only one that's Lefi Ruach HaYireim.
That could be your new motto.
Lefi Ruach HaYireim. I can see that being catchy.
His thing about like not being economically interested reminds me of a case from like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
The guy got money for his tools. Where one day had a business like getting money for
these. Yes, that's why I introduced that case. I knew this was coming, and because that case is real. Right? I think that's a big issue. Let's say a different case. Let's suppose it happens not to compete, but Milt's Barbecue in Chicago, right, which is a purely charity, right, where all profits go to charity. Right, so suppose that were started and it competed with an existing for-profit barbecue. Right, so Ramosha would make it worse that it was a charitable barbecue.
Like, are you saying that they have kosher food kitchens, right? Must be in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So let's say Brooklyn is tiny and it's 1958, and there's one kosher restaurant that's a for profit, the Duggies or Kosher Delight.
Yes.
And then there's Must Be comes to town, and their food kitchen, and it's operated like a restaurant in the way that you go and you get food, and you pay what you wish. So Rav Moshe would say, being that Kosher Delight is losing money, the food kitchen can't open up.
Mike?
This is totally, this is like actually like speaking a different language.
Yes?
We share no common principles of economics with Rav Moshe. I'm serious.
Not economics, you share different presumptions of the role economics play, or the role of the positions people play in society.
I don't even think so.
He's not claiming the economic consequences will be different. He's not a different cause and effect. It's different values. He's not saying that if you increase supply that you'll increase that you'll raise prices, and if you increase demand you'll lower prices.
I think he is. That's the point, right? We live in a society where we must protect the consumer at all costs, right?
But he's not denying what will happen to the consumer. He just that's a value issue that you must protect the consumer.
I think it's an empirical disagreement.
What empirical statement would you make that you would disagree with?
That competition for rabbis is good for the rabbinic market.
What does that mean, good for the rabbinic market?
We get better rabbis when there's competition for rabbis.
Ah, that's an interesting question. You get better when rabbis compete with each other. You get better rabbis. So he goes out of his way to tell you, right? In the next section,
that Kina. Right. This is the exact. It's an empirical disagreement. I think this is the correct.
You think that's empirical? You think that's empirical?
Yes.
I think he may just not care.
I think that's a much more radical claim than mine.
He's not interested in better rabbis.
He doesn't think that rabbis will be created by competing with rabbis.
I agree with the Klapa, but I think you're saying it wrong. He doesn't think that rabbis are rabbis.
Yes.
They're not Sofim. They're not Chokhmah. They're Gittin and weddings and,
That's right.
Life cycle events. It's not anything having to do with
He doesn't see the position of shul rabbi as a niche in the market.
He sees the position of shul. He sees this the position of this rabbi as a position which, if compromised or challenged, would make it worse for everybody.
No.
Not just yes. Otherwise, he wouldn't.
You keep saying that. I think he thinks.
Otherwise, Kuntzer would apply.
I think he thinks of it in the way that, that somebody gets appointed as. Somebody gets appointed. Let's say that the point I was making about the Israeli rabbinate, right, from Professor Furziger, that the Israeli rabbinate is not the American shul rabbinate; it's the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. Right, that's what it is. Right, they have a whole lot of paperwork requirements. They have to write and technical requirements. They have to fulfill for you, and that's your expectation. When you walk into the rabbinate, you're not expecting to walk into somebody who's going to make your life experience meaningful. If you walk into the bureau, right, now it happens that for many kids, right, what's the most powerful experience of their teenagerhood?
Getting
your license, right? So again, we have a big ceremony where all the kids get up and get their license, and we present them with a book, and we recite the Tefillah Sederach, right? That was one of Danny Lehman's big thing, kosher driving, and all sorts of things, because here we're giving you the capacity, the capacity to control people's lives, right? Life and death is in your hands, all those sorts of things. Now imagine, right? Does anybody walk into the registry of motor vehicles and expect the person who greets you is going to say, "Welcome to you. Our job is to try and have your licensing experience."
I expect the exact opposite.
No, it's like a ceremony. You walk in. They
I expect to make
you,
my
walk around the DMV seven times.
So, Rav Moshe thinks of the job of the shul rabbi is the Israeli rabbi. There are certain kinds of paperwork you have to accomplish. There are certain kinds of things you have to enable a person to do. Meaning is not part of it. If you provide meaning, okay. Call it kavod.
No, but the principle of kinat sofrim tamar chachma, right, is that everybody's better off when we have sofrim compete.
Sofrim?
Yes.
So we want better Torah.
The principle is, fine. The empirical disagreement is about whether rabbis are sofrim or not.
That's not empirical.
Yes, it's not value, it's empirical. Because he's talking about a period of time or place wherein rabbis were not sofrim, whereas we don't even have such a conception now.
Right, we don't have such a conception of rabbis as sofrim now. We don't think the rabbinic competition makes the rabbis better learners.
Why? I think we do. I mean, some of us do.
Mostly it's the other way around. For rabbinic competition,
different kinds of competition.
Different goals.
Like, shul rabbi competition is different than like academic rabbi competition.
That's right, but different goals. Right, Rav Moshe's goal is the production of much better academics.
We think if a shul rabbi's position is in the hands of somebody that is not the shul rabbi, then he will do a better job, for the most part, except we have issues.
Because you think there is such a job.
Yeah, it's an empirical, because there is right now, and in his time there wasn't.
Well, I know, he didn't see it as a value for there to be such a job.
What?
It didn't exist. The same way it doesn't exist in Israel. Right? People keep talking Israel. What we need is the American-style shul rabbi. But there isn't such a position right now. Right? It's a created position. The same way you're like walking into the 17th century and saying, what we need is a rabbi who gives better sermons. What? Sermons? You mean like the Christians?
Well, in Italy, it was
already. Okay, right. They're always if you walked in, right, if you walked in to 17th, right, you walked into 17th, 18th century, right, Europe, and you say, I don't understand, your rabbi's not giving good enough sermons. I'm going to go somewhere to the rabbi. What? If you want sermons, hire a magid.
But the reason it's problematic is because they're not saying there is something that he's not doing. They're not saying, we wish he was doing this, but he's not.
That's right, no.
They're saying what he is doing, so what he considers to be his job. Like, let him define what his job is. Okay, so his definition of his job is to say, speak X times, do X counseling, or whatever it is, provide X services, and they think he's doing a bad job at that.
He's at the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and people are standing online, and as they're standing online, somebody comes out from behind the desk and right and walks over to somebody and says, oh, all you guys waiting for licenses, you're all evil communists, and then walks back behind the desk and fills out the form nicely.
I would say that there's a right to fire that guy.
Okay.
He's not allowed to abuse people
That's
while
right.
he does his job.
Okay.
I don't think this guy is...
So, and Rav Moshe agrees that if you were genuinely abusing people regularly, Rav Moshe's standards are lower than yours. He thinks he only abused them a couple of times.
And calling people communists isn't even that bad.
It's a mitzvah to set up a new shul to stop him from being Iran and Astvarim.
Aha.
That's great.
Look, you can always say that Rav Moshe also, you know, we don't know who this fellow is, and Rav Moshe could have deep sympathy, he could be a Holocaust survivor, and Rav Moshe thinks he's working through his issues and they should be sympathetic. Right? And all of you know in your own lives, I hope, right, you know people who you genuinely like, who every once in a while go off, right, go off and do things that you would never tolerate from somebody else, but you sort of wave it off. You probably have relatives like that. No, you don't have any relatives like that?
I didn't wave it off.
You didn't wave it off.
Wait, I know, I'm 100% with Elliot.
That's interesting.
Common,
like, I do.
People doing horrible things, you don't.
Horrible things, yeah. People yell at you. People even say insulting things to you. Now, communist is not something I've been called for quite some time, I think.
Quite difficult to call you
But here's his card.
But certainly, I had friends in yeshiva who would do things that's bad or worse.
But doing something one time is not the same as doing it habitually.
Right.
Yeah, this is a total, I
feel like we're making valid judgments on Rav Moshe versus just trying to understand his argument, which is...
That is also a fair
that's
point.
That's the thing, I think it's, I think maybe just me, maybe I'm operating in a totally different world universe than Rav Moshe. I can't speak for everybody else, but I think a lot of the disagreement is rooted in the fact that we have different conceptions about...
Okay, good, so let's...
This is burritos and tacos all over again.
No, this isn't.
Okay, good. So coming out of this though. Coming out of this, what I want to get out of this is, right, let's watch the way Rav Moshe frames it. Because Rav Moshe frames it from his perspective is, if this were a question of money, Rav Moshe says this is a question of Isser. You're being Yored, that's the way he frames it again. You are being Yored L'chaye Chavercha. Right? So if you leave this shul, you will be Yored L'chaye Chavercha. That's an Isser. So you better have a value that justifies being Yored L'chaye Chavercha. And by the same token, right, from his perspective, so take away Rabbi. Right, take away Rabbi. Right. The question is, if there's a flour miller, right, look, right, we'll call it the mill Nazi. every time you come and grind your flour, right, there's a chance they'll call you a communist and such forth. Does that entitle you the sad brother millstone and right across the right into the mud boy?
If he's calling me, well, the question is calling you a communist in the 1950s calling you a Russian?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, so that's an empirical dispute.
Four after Rosa Parks, 57.
And the coffee stopped in 50s.
He went down because he was a terrible human being. The idea that a communist was a Russian was still there.
Yeah, he was not calling you a communist, as in you're a sympathizer with the goal of creating a workers' paradise. Right? If he's calling you a communist, means he's calling you a Stalinist anti-Semite. That's what he's right. A godless
or a secularist.
Yeah. So after right, this is not a McCarthy-esque thing where the Rebbe is accusing him of being disloyal to the United States. Right? That's not what communism means here. Right? He's playing out, right? He's playing out experiences in Russia. Okay. So the question regarding Rav Moshe here is, can you can you really pull out the can you pull out just his standard for what's considered miyat parnasa? Do you buy his claim that miyat parnasa is the same as yored lumnaso, at least under certain circumstances? Do you care about the official circumstances? You just set that out, and then do you buy his standard? So here, spiel, which is useful. Right? So one of the most important and creative things that posts can do is they set standards where none of what has not been created before. So easy example. Rav Moshe in the Tesex Tshuva says that, well, you know what? We have a Gemara which says Bahadi Kavshid Rachman Alamalach, right? That Yeshaya says to Chizkiah, you have no right not to have children because you have a prophetic information that your son is going to be evil, right? Because these secrets of God, what do you have to do with this? You shouldn't think about that. So that should ban genetic testing, right? Whatever, you can't know anything about what your kids are going to be like. So the Rav Moshe says, but there's not, right? But that doesn't, the notion, the Hadei Kashi Rachman Alamalach, doesn't mean that when you're walking across a field full of deep pits that you should go like this. Right? Yeah, right? If you don't look ahead of you, then you're responsible, right? So any notion that you're supposed to walk innocently without knowledge of the future doesn't extend to walking blindly. So he sets up a whole new, he sets up, right? And then he has to set up a standard, right? What is the parameter? The Noda Behuda and the Amazing Autopsy Tshuva.
That was Tesex.
Rav Moshe sets up a new standard. Right? His standard is whatever the position which you can. Rav Moshe believes there is a traditional position which says that you're supposed to walk with faith in God and not think excessively about the future. And this position comes as a whole set of halachic tshuvos, insurance, genetic testing, all sorts of things about that. He said whatever that standard is, it doesn't mean that you're supposed to not look down where you're walking.
Wait, what was the
tshuva? The Maisa was he allows Tay-Sex testing.
Oh, testing.
It's
for testing.
He allows Tay-Sex testing.
And then what happens when you know?
Then you have a baby.
Rosh allows Tay-Sex testing. This is for the parents,
not testing
the fetus.
Pre-marriage.
He doesn't use the fetus. He says you're a rush if you test the fetus.
Yes, because he thinks you're gonna end up.
What about testing post-marriage, pre?
Again, he's allowing testing. Well, probably he would allow that also, but that depends on what he would have thought of PIGD, which is a whole separate.
Would he allow contraception?
All separate question. We don't want to go there. Right? I just, but that's a case where, right? Where you set up, you had on the one hand you're supposed to walk innocently with right tum and tiyam Hashem lekecha. On the other hand, there's like some kind of common sense. The Rav Moshe sets up the standard. The standard is you're not supposed to walk blindly into the future. Right? Don't blindfold yourself. Right? In the autopsy tshuva, the Nevi Yehuda sets up the standard called chola b'faneinu. It's because nefesh if there's a sick person in front of you, not if there isn't. Right? That's how he has to try and find a way to set on the one hand, right, that pikuach nefesh on the one hand there really is a standard called pikuach nefesh. On the other hand, right, why is it that the janitor in a cancer research facility can't drive in on Shabbos? Right, because after all, if the janitor doesn't clean, eventually the building breaks down. If the building breaks down, then the researchers can't come in. Right, you go from the janitor to the researcher, right, to the lead researcher, right? Why? What point? Right, because if nefesh can go to whatever, or the easy case that's not so talked about is medical school. Right, can you go to medical school on Shabbos?
Well, I cannot.
Go on and go to medical school. Right, we're still bothered by this notion. Somebody viewed a. Creates a standard kolchola b'fneinu. We could talk about whether it's a good standard or a bad standard, whether it survives. But part of what a posek has to do is set a standard. Right? So Rav Moshe here sets a standard. Miyat parnasato means, and he has a definition.
You might make me a kolchola b'fneinu.
No, I don't want to go there. Just a standard. He has to set it up. Okay. So this is, and because Rav Moshe is the only one, really, that we've seen, who set up a standard, right? The only right people had extremes. You eliminate his parnasa, right? There's space for both of you, right? It's common sense that there has to be some level, short of driving someone out of business, which is considered yored lumnaso. Although not necessarily, you can say the standard is If he stays in business, then obviously he can still make a living from it.
We've had other people set standards.
What's the standard?
We've had someone say as long as it doesn't... We've had someone make the diminishing his standard of living argument before.
So I didn't know why you, Truva. Did we see that from somewhere
that
else?
That sounds familiar to me.
I don't know,
yeah.
So let's try and find it.
In the case like Chuva sets up a totally different standard.
Yeah, which is?
If it destroys your business venture.
It destroys the business venture, right? So it could be that particular.
Yeah, right. We definitely had someone who said that if you change
the
standard of living, then it's your Edom Muta.
I have to figure
that's
out.
This. That's this.
It's all based on this.
No, before Rajactor.
It's all based on this Chuva.
Who else said it?
Anybody coming after this Chuva.
No, we had someone.
Okay,
there.
So go find it.
So what?
And feel free to email this one out.
I don't remember.
I really want to see it.
Let's find it. Okay. Okay. So the the next Rav Moshe talks about the question of knowledge or not having knowledge, and he decides that knowledge is irrelevant. And then he tries to set up a standard as to what he has to set up two other standards. What is the degree of certainty of other employment that is necessary to make something mecher as opposed to hefker or matana? Right, that is something that we did see. Who already talked about assumption of risk? Already talked about assumption of risk, the Marshal, right?
He legislated out of existence.
Pardon?
He legislated it out of existence, right? He said there's no such thing as not being able to get this.
Right.
Software.
So here we have a revisiting. Rav Moshe is trying to revisit that question. Right, that he says Aval Kushrak Shemalacha Kharaz Lo Yasib Ashum Ofin Shaykh Lomar Shim Bir Zir Zu like a Makalinsali Stakalinamachirim who kafkir matana. Right, it's only right, we're so on the bottom of page 7 or so. Right? 1, 3, so prime of 6. The page that starts at the top should Tov Masu with Nimishur Sadin. Right, so in the paragraph on the bottom says Achyesh Lodun. Right? He says that it's only
it's page 7.
It is page 7?
Yeah.
Okay, so right, it's the page that begins Tov Masu with Nimishur Sadin. So in the second last paragraph on the bottom, he sets up a similar standard. He says that it's only considered a mitziah or a hefker if there's no way you would get get another job. But if you would get another job similarly, if it's possible that you would get another job, and even if you wouldn't get the same kind of living, but you could get some kind of job, you're still considered mafik becharor if you interfere with this job. Right, so this sort of goes in the so he ends up thinking mafik becharor has very broad appearance, very broad application. If you take someone's job away, even if that means that you're going to have to search for another job, even if it means you're not sure you're going to get another job, even if it means that you might not get as good a job, you're still...
So it is the same as the Marshal.
So it goes in the same direction as the Marshal.
For labor, not consumption goods. For employment, not consumption goods.
Marshal ends up claiming... Marshal ends up on whose side? Marshal ends up on the second guy's side, right? And Ramosha ends... No, it's the reverse of the Marshal.
No.
Marshall's talking about other reasons to end up in the same
okay, fine. So it's in the same direction. Okay, then he talks about the standard as to what, how far people have to have, right? People have to have gone in the process for it to consider to be mahapech bechoror. And there he sets up a very odd standard, where he says he goes against the Ramah. He says if you've hit the point where it's clear they're going to reach agreement, they just haven't reached agreement on price yet. That's mahapech bechoror. Right, it's only right at the even if they haven't agreed on the price, but if you've hit that point in the negotiations where it's clear that we're going to reach an agreement, we just haven't yet. That's already mapech becharora. So that itself is an interesting claim. Right, and then that he goes into much more detail in the shidduch case. Much more detail. Yes.
Like, how useful is it for him to have this whole halichos about everything, and then at some point be like, and this is all useless if you actually know whether it's hefker or not, and you can figure that out yourself.
It's all useless.
Like, it basically, he says, if it's hefker, you could compete, and this whole thing is not lemaisa at all.
Yes. So he's writing to yeshiva students, right? And this is a didactic tshuva, right? For Moshe's saying, right? Moshe's trying to get them. This, I guess, is parallel to what we did last year. Or was it last year, right? The tshuva about whether you can force, a couple years ago, you can force kids to tell on each other. I thought this is one of my favorite tshuvas of Moshe. Can a teacher force kids in school to tell on each other?
The big lesson in my book
says no. So Moshe has a beautiful tshuva about this. Because he's stuck. You don't. You want to teach the kids not to say Lashon Hara, but you also don't want this omerta system where the kids protect them, where the kids protect each other no matter what happens. Right? The administration has to find out who did things. And if you only expect people to confess, it's not going to happen, right? So if somebody's stealing stuff from locker, you know, whatever. Somebody's misbehaving. So Rav Moshe ends up, as I understand him, with this really cool in-between position where he says that the teacher cannot force the students to tell them. Because that would be the teacher inculcating virtue. The teacher's job is to inculcate in students the judgment to decide whether to tell them. That's what he thinks. That's what chinuch is, right? Chinuch is, right? Chinuch is not lining the students up against the wall and say, right, if you haven't told me who did this by 4:30 today, then nobody gets ice cream for the rest of the week. Right? All that does is teach students that. Lashon Hara is whatever. Lashon Hara is anything that the school, you know, that Lashon Hara is whatever is against the interests of the school and the administration. Whatever is in the interests of the establishment is not Lashon Hara. So that he thinks that's bad chinuch. Good chinuch is, right, kids should be able to know when they have to tell you and when they don't, because sometimes they have to tell you and sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's dangerous for the school, right? You want kids to have the good judgment to tell you. Let's say, scenarios. Let's say you want students to spontaneously tell you if another kid in the school is dealing drugs. Pardon? Or bringing their gun to school, right? You do want that, right? You do want them to tell you that. But on the other hand, let's suppose that we had a case again, right, where a kid by accident brought in a thing of live ammunition.
Accident?
Of what? Accident. He'd gone to a shooting range, and it was in his backpack. And
he
had
didn't
the
have a gun.
Didn't have a gun.
Just the jersey.
Yeah.
No, it's a bullet.
Misfortune, it fell out of his backpack, and all of a sudden, right, you're saying, right, all of a sudden, right, a kid has to come report. There's live ammunition on the floor.
No, I'd say in that case, it's still, I don't know. I think it's good for the administration to know. I think it's up to the administration to handle it in a way where it.
So the question is, do kids have to tell you? A kid did something innocent, they know who it was. Do they have to tell you?
I don't think. Weaponry is a good example, even though
obviously,
but I mean, well, I don't know.
I don't know, right? So, you know.
I just don't want kids making that decision.
So that's
like,
whole,
oh, I trust that the guy doesn't also have a gun in his locker.
So that's all right. So it might be, right? But Rav Moshe's point is that the goal is to inculcate in kids the judgment. And if the kids decide otherwise, then you're almost never in a, right, unless you're in a life and death situation. And you might think you're in a life and death situation with live ammunition. But unless you're in a life and death situation, so it's not a good idea for the administration to force the kids. To force the kids to say Lashon Hara, because that is bad chinuch. And so I think Rav Moshe here does something similar. That, you know, that as opposed to paskening, what he does is he gives them, he says, you know what, I could pasken it, but I don't need to pasken it because you're good people. And now you can go off, and this is what Rabbi Jachar talked about yesterday, right, which is parallel to what Benjamin Friedman says about the difference between a duties-based consultation and a rights-based consultation. Right, so what he's trying to do in the movement is the thing is the question here is not who has right who gets the money, right? That's not right. And do I get the money? Do you get the money? The question here is who should get the money, and that's shared. So work it out, right? And I think that's right. And since that tshuva is written explicitly to two yeshiva students, so that's what he wants for them. He wants to move them from the space where they are yelling at each other, "It's my money, it's your money," to the space where I don't know whose money it is, right? Whoever God wants to have the money should have the money. Let's figure out who God wants to have the money. So I think that's beautiful, and I think that, there again, that may only be a master's. But if somebody could collect all the examples in Rav Moshe where one does that, or a paper, I think that would be very cool if you could find that Rav Moshe has, right, particularly writing to yeshiva students. That would be my suspicion, is that writing to yeshiva students and writing about education, Rav Moshe very consistently frames his psak in ways that are character development as opposed to outcomes.
Like the waiting and waiting opinion thing.
Fred?
We can't play for Minion. Like, when the ball goes, ask him whether he can make a play for Minion. He says yes, and when the issue is student test, and then he can make a play for Minion, he says no.
Yeah, so this is part of the whole different class things. This is part of the whole question that, you know, that we all need to think about is just, so there's the rabbinic role, and then there's the yeshiva student role. So the yeshiva student role, so in Israel, we call this the draft problem, right? When everyone's a yeshiva student, so right, who gets drafted? And, right, so in America, you have the same issue, whether you're supposed to educate yeshiva students to think of themselves as an elite. Or day school students. So day school students certainly were educated to think of themselves as an elite, until 20, 30 years ago. All right, that was certainly like you were a student of X school, Maimonides, Ramaz, and then all of a sudden day school became really, really standard. And it stopped making sense to think of that way in the same way that it stopped making sense to have a draft exemption for yeshiva students when yeshiva students are a central part of the culture. So Lichtenstein, in one of his pieces years ago, said that he thought in Europe it was when yeshiva students basically had to go take their rice bowls and go begging door to door. So it was essential to build in a sense of pride that you were better than the Baal HaBatim. Because the Baal HaBatim were looking at you as these, you know, as these ridiculous, threadbare beggars. And you look at yourself and you, like the Meraglim, you always internalize how other people think of you. Right? So you think of yourself as a beggar. So the only way to change that was I'm engaged in a higher calling. And he said that, you know what, maybe they did their job a little bit too well. And maybe now, when yeshiva students aren't begging, and in fact are living, you know, well supported by the community, and what we call the yeshiva student has really changed from, you know, I have to say, when I read, reading in some of these Musar histories and reading like what it was like to join some of these Musar yeshivot, so the whole environment is completely different, right? You basically were in a war against the communists for the kids. So if the kids joined your yeshiva, the parents would throw you out because, right, you were betraying communism. And the kids would march through the town displaying the rebellion against their parents by going to yeshiva. And they were starving. Right? They were literally starving, and the whole environment was different. That's very hard for me to get, you know, since I grew up in an environment where day school was, right, where day school was really standard. So reading Rav Moshe's Trivot, so the role of rabbi is very, very different. We saw that really quite dramatically today, and I thought that's a really cool conversation that's worth having in lots of environments. Right? Read this Trivot of Moshe. What does it say to you about the rabbinic role, right? And how do we relate to that? And the second question is the whole notion that yeshiva students are a class who are dressed differently than lay people. Right? Yeshiva students are rabbis in training. Right? Yeshiva students are talmidei chachamim in training. Pardon?
Good catch.
Yeah. Right. So that whole notion, right? And talmidei chachamot. Right, so that whole notion is, you know, that whole notion grates against, you know, the American notion that we don't have class consciousness, right? And we're going to create all these guys who vote for Adlai Stevenson. Right, who needs that? So I think that's a really deep question: the extent to which yeshiva students should be a class. And now that relates to halacha because we have all these things for Tzuvah Mirabbanan, which assume that rabbis are supposed to have economic advantages. Right? And yeshiva students are supposed to have economic advantages. They're not supposed to be supported by the community directly. They're supposed to get economic advantages, and that gives them probably a somewhat less stable income, but it gives them an explicitly superior social status.
I would say Tzuvah Mirabbanan, assume that, like, there's a predicate by Tzuvah Mirabbanan in the Gemara that the rabbi has a job. That's why we give him an advantage, because he's a rabbi, he has the money from that, he's a poor. And because he's risking his time and his effort, he's allowed to work. But, like, that assumes he's actually working.
Yeah, so that's a whole different model.
Tzuvah Mirabbanan is not cool, check.
But again, what you mean by working, so, right, you have a tradition of sinecures.
What?
Sinecures, right? Those were jobs you gave. Nathaniel Hawthorne was collector of the port of somewhere in Massachusetts. That was supposed to be a job that he had to work at a few hours a week and gave him time to write. That's why he had that job. Because you had, right, this was part of patronage, right? Part of patronage was you had a number of jobs which were not hard work, but which we, a certain amount of money was allocated to. If you read, so part of my reading this spring was I was reading through Trollope's Barchester Tower series, which, when it's not being anti-Semitic, is often wonderful. There are lots of quotes there that really, it's a good thing of them for my share tonight, right, where he talks about it's a bad idea to believe that clergy are not human beings. Because you know, it just comes out, right? To expect rabbis to have no bodies is, right? Is to, you know, be bad, to inevitably be disappointed. But one of the things you get is there's a whole fight about the way the Church of England was set up. There were these livings, right? If you got to be priest of a particular parish, you got a certain amount of money, and it didn't depend on how many people there were. It just depended, right? That's when they took the money away from the Catholic Church. That's how they divided it up. And so there would be all these fights in Parliament about how, why does the Church have the right to give 400 such and such to so and so? What is he? Just an elderly music scholar. But the Church is a patron, and here's a guy. He's a music scholar. We want to develop him, right? Why should, right? We think it'll contribute greatly to society. We have this job. Let's give him this job. It doesn't really matter who does this job, because there's not much of a job to do. So that's a particular system, and most. Right, so nowadays we don't have it. Right, nowadays we have what we call liberal arts fellowships. Right, we have some job, like Poet Laureate of the United States. Does it really matter what a Poet Laureate of the United States does? But we used to have a. I'm sorry if one of you is the grandson of the Poet Laureate. I'm sure Robert Pinsky was great. as opposed to the Poet Laureate of New Jersey, who I was less happy with some time ago.
New Jersey has a poet laureate.
New Jersey had a poet laureate, but it became very controversial because it had a poet laureate who had published some really virulently anti-Semitic things.
Who was that?
I don't remember. It had two different names also. You have to change his name at some point.
I really didn't know that we had a poet laureate.
You're not from this
Jersey.
Of course.
Isn't it Billy Collins now?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So you have every culture has to find ways to do that. So, right, people find, I don't know how much, when we say that the rabbi worked, so what it means was that the town tried to, you know, he tried to find the job that he could do really simply, and without putting any effort into it. That was the best case scenario. You know, a turnkey job. It doesn't mean that you wanted your rabbi to work 9 to 5 in a foundry, because he couldn't learn that way. Not everybody is a Torah Tmima, you know, memorizing. Reciting tshuva under your breath as you're counting money as a teller in a bank or something like that, right? Not so many people have that capacity. So that's the whole question about whether you really want to. I'll say, like, one of the modern Orthodox legend of Brown Rebel, a Texas oilman.
Yes.
Brown Rebel founded YU, right? He was a Texas oilman. But his relatives claim that wasn't it. It was that his brother was a Texas oilman, right? And he has a brother who was a scholar. So he just gives him a job in the oil company. Because that's what you do. You find a place in the oil company for your scholarly brother. Because what's he going to do? Drill? So the other side of the family is kind of bitter about the Bernard Rebel Texas oilman thing. If you talk to them, I happen to eat dinner with them at a hotel because they think that their contributions are underappreciated. They think their grandfather. Right, supported all this Torah by creating a job for him, and instead we have this legend of the entrepreneur, and Torah Mata and all that. So that, I think that's
It's probably also not just Torah Mata, but an idea of what we value in economic development.
So it was oil, right? So oil from back.
No, the entrepreneur.
Yes, right. No. So that's part of the whole. That's what we. Part of it is we want a legend. We should want a legend of yeshiva students who really could be anything and choose to be yeshiva students, right? That's part of the legend, right? That's why we like the rabbi who was drafted by a professional baseball team. One of the rabbis in town, there is such a legend. I think he confirms it, right? That he was, you know, drafted by the Pirates or something like that. And, right? We all, you know, those are all things you want, right? You want, right?
Pirates.
Yeah, right. What kind of draft? Right? What kind of scouting do they have anyway, right? And maybe his brother-in-law was right. You never know. But those are the we like having legends like that. So we like the notion that, you know, that the rabbi, you know, would really be Warren Buffett if he hadn't chosen to be the rabbi. And some of that's true. deeply influential moment in my life was Rabbi Maurice Corson saying to me at one point, and a friend of mine, so imagine if Leslie Wexner, when he was 21, had said, enough with this clothing stuff. I want to go to rabbinical school. How much influence would he have in the Jewish community today? That was a little sad.
Well, he wasn't in clothing at 21, was he?
Yeah, it's an inherited business.
Wait.
He was...
It's an inherited business.
What's sad about that?
Well, because I was going out to be a rabbinical school because I thought I wanted to have influence on the Jewish community, but apparently... Apparently, I should have gone... Right, I should have gone off...
How many other people going to business are influencing the Jewish community? I mean...
Right, so the answer is, it's probably not true. It's probably not true that I would not have been... I would not have been even as successful, so to speak, in the world, right, in the world of clothing as I am, in the world of rabbinics, to the extent I am. Whatever it is... Probably, you know, but I think that that's a fair point. Yes, it probably.
He might have been a very important judge.
Yeah, that might have been a very important Supreme Court justice. That's true. That one I still feel guilty about.
If you had been a Supreme Court justice, you could safely say that you would be an important one. I think most.
That's true. Most Supreme Court justices.
You would say.
Unless you just let your clerks run everything, I guess then you're still important. And you can provide employment for your Shiva students.
No, actually, I like totally agree with you. Almost every, like most people who are really good at. Rabbinics might be really good at finance or law.
Might be, and might
make a lot of money in that industry, and it might be able to support the Jewish community a lot better through that industry than the rabbinics.
That's a fair problem.
But also, those are professions; those aren't becoming a clothing acting profession.
That's a problem. Or
we don't have such a thing, so we should only encourage the non-smart.
Okay, last thing
I shall quote.
Make more money if you become an investment banker.
Can we do the last thing?
Yes, I shall quote Chaim's father in conclusion. There's a part that is a lesson he told me from his Mashkiach years ago, which is, I think, worth thinking about, although not terribly relevant to our Shiva, maybe. So he said that his Mashkiach years ago told him that the reason the Yeshivot opposed college was not because they opposed college. But now I'm going to paraphrase here, but because Yeshivot are endeavors that run on philanthropy. Right, that was the case then, right? They weren't tuition-sustained institutions. They were philanthropy-sustained institutions. Philanthropy-sustained institutions depend on disposable income, and disposable income depends on large income disparities. So if you run a cultural institution like a museum or a yeshiva, what you want is income inequality. Because income inequality is what leads to philanthropy. And the mashal is, right? So let's suppose that... Here, you guys are my... I'm investing in you guys, right? You're my whole financial support for the next 50 years. So I have... You know, how many of you do I have in the room? I have 14 of you in the room. So let's suppose that all of you become doctors. And you all are reasonably successful, so you all make incomes of $200,000 a year.
How about
this number?
That's not very successful for them.
Okay, $300,000 a year.
What if it was $200,000 after malpractice insurance?
Yes. Now let's say $300,000. So that means that your total income a year is $4.2 million. Now how much stock is going to come out of that?
Depends on whether or not you follow Takanas Usha or not.
Well, we're all going to be.
So you follow what?
Takanas Usha.
Uh huh.
What?
Okay.
If you get more than 20%, then you'll get a lot more stock up.
let's say normal 420,000.
Maybe, right? Because the answer is, right, all of you will live at a level that basically spends close to $300,000 a year. You're not going to give enough stucca, most of you, to lower your standard of income, your standard of living below that of the person who makes approximately $300,000 a year. Right? That's right. And there actually is right. There actually isn't so much disposable income.
In fact, we might make friends with lots of people who are also making.
You'll want to live in a neighborhood with people who make roughly the same income, and you're going to want to dress right like the people you work with. And you're going to need vacations because you're working really, really hard at these jobs, and nobody expects you. They'll tell you that it's a violation of self-care, right? If you don't go on vacations, and so yeah, so the total amount of so maybe right, if we're lucky, we'll get my $420,000 a year. Now let's suppose instead I send the 16 of you out to be entrepreneurs. Now let's suppose that most of you are miserable at this. So at the end of it, so we have 14 of you, right? So let's suppose that 12 of you make $50,000 a year and barely get by. So now we've made $600,000. And one of you is reasonably successful and makes, I don't know, say $400,000 a year. So now we've gotten up to $1 million. And one of you is successful and you make $3.2 million. The person who makes $3.2 million can give $1 million a year without noticing it, really. So we've now just doubled Even if none of the rest of you give a cent, right? Income inequality doubles or triples the amount of income available for tzedakah.
Is that true?
Yeah, but why do you assume that the millionaire won't just hang out with the millionaires?
So you have to make sure. You have to make sure that you live in a culture where there isn't that millionaire culture.
The same
right, they're still living in the from community. They're still right, so they'll have a lot more. So the argument was that, and I think it's certainly true that that middle class cultures have trouble sustaining high culture because they don't have that much disposable income.
I think it's similar to the economic rule, the 80-20 rule.
Yeah, 90-10, 99-1.
Is that what you're saying?
Wait, what rule are you talking about?
In fundraising, they teach you, right? 90% of the money comes from 10% of the people. 80% of the money comes from 20% of the people.
In everything, like most industry comes from a small percentage.
Yeah. So that's a fair question. What should the economic goal of the? I used to, I still enjoy like asking people. So does Judaism have anything to say about income inequality? Right. It's one of the great moral issues of our time, supposedly.
Right? Only if you're on the. One of the ends of the spectrum.
Yes.
No, both have adopted that.
I said both, yeah.
Yeah.
One, if you're on one of the ends, if you're in the middle, you don't care so much.
Okay, but let's say, right, do we have anything to say about it?
Yeah, you're evil.
Do we care? Right? Do we, right, you know, they have one end of the spectrum, you're Vinayan Randian, right? Everyone should get exactly what they produce. And you have another version which assumes that any diversion from equality, Peter Singer, right, where we should be splitting the assets equally with cows.
Torah assumes inequality to some extent.
The Torah assumes that inequality will happen, but is it seen as an evil?
Torah assumes inequality, but also
you have to prove that it does.
Huge measures in order to assure equality.
Does it?
Yovel.
Ah, so some people build up Yovel, and some people build up Hilchot Tzedakah. Right? It's another
version. Hilchot Tzedakah isn't making everybody equal.
That's right. So the thought question I like to start off with, is, you know, when people sort of sputter about the income inequality one, is whether a socialist economy fulfills the mitzvah of tzedakah or eliminates it.
That was,
Depends how you see the sugya in Baba Basra, in the beginning of Baba Basra, with the tax, the tzedakah collectors coming out and saying, we need this money, and are those taxes for social welfare and defense, or are those tzedakah collectors?
Aha, you think
Levine
that way.
Seems to say that it's
interesting, I don't know if that's proof. Pardon?
Aaron Levine, when he talks about minimum wage legislation, he talks about it like tzedakah.
Yes.
So it sounds like a socialist economy would fulfill his idea.
No, because a socialist economy.
People make, and therefore everyone is supported. So
it's an interesting question whether he would think of an economy where you have the money and then redistribute it is different than an economy where you never get it in the first place. So it might be stuck en masse if you transfer money, but a socialist economy you never have it.
There's a.
I don't know if from a local perspective you would see a difference.
Okay, interesting point. All right, Spamacha.
It seems like we believe in a combination of taxation and personal donation.
Could be. So we have a mixed economy.
We have a minimum and a maximum for tzedakah.
Locke says that the justification of private property is virtue. You can't have the purpose, right, that in a socialist economy there is no virtue of tzedakah. There's no virtue of generosity. So I think that's a fair issue. I only bring this up here now because I think that when you're talking about, right, part of the issue is the extent to what is your overall framing of how an economy should be structured and what the purposes of this an economy is. And it might be that we might try and frame halacha on the assumption that we're going for social, right, for social equality, and we care about everybody, and everybody should have roughly the same income. And it might not be that we care that way. I'm not sure. Okay.
Okay.
Summary for the day. Right, you know what I want to think about whether the standard that is derived by the way you bait in for Rav Moshe is fair. I want to think about whether the Rav Moshe is a really good precedent, given that it rests on so many economic and social presumptions that seem challenging. Is this particular standard separable? And we just say, you know what, the rest of Rav Moshe we have trouble with, but this standard is fine, it's a totally independent thing.
Which standard?
Right, social status standard, right? Right, is that something, right, is that connected, or is that part of Rav Moshe's worldview? And if it is part of Rav Moshe's worldview and you have trouble accepting it, what do you do with that? Do you say, well, I need to revise my worldview so it's in accordance with Rav Moshe? Or do you say that reality has changed and we need to find a way to translate the values that Rav Moshe expressed in his society into contemporary legislation? Do you say, I need to find somebody who has a very different perspective than Rav Moshe? I need to evaluate how well Rav Moshe fits into the precedents that we saw. You know, how well does he fit with some sofer in the Pesachei Tshuva? How well does he not? All those sorts of things. Schedule-wise, I think my plan is let's assume, I don't want to have the risk of going forever, let's assume that we're going to start at 11 tomorrow, and that, right, for sure, we're going to finish Rav Moshe, we're going to do the Pesachei Tshuva with some sofer, and then we'll send you, I'll send you off to finish reading, you'll already have started reading, I'll send you off to finish reading everything, and we'll think about whether I have anything more to say, that I need to say before you start writing. Possibly not. Possibly you're all grown up now. Sorry, if you had something you wanted to say, you never got to say.
I mean, it was really